said on Movement, this artist, that are due to lesions of the cerebellum. So we are going to go through the cerebellar function, its anatomy, and then we're going to look at some characteristic signs and symptoms that we can see in patients who have cerebellar lesions. Okay, so we're going to describe the normal functions of the cerebellum. We're going to look at the rules that govern its functions. Of course, we look at the anatomy and the variation of the cerebellar function. So for different regions of the cerebellum, there are different functions, and we're going to go through that. We're going to look at some input and output routes for the cerebellum. Then we're going to compare the histological variances between the cerebellum and the cerebrum. We're also going to look at the synaptic organization for the cerebellar cortex. We're going to look at the different cerebellar nuclei and what regions of the cerebellum those nuclei communicate with. Then we're going to look at lesions of the cerebellum and their manifestations so that we can be able to predict what regions of the cerebellum would cause what particular malfunctions or motor disorders. Okay, so this 58-year-old man, he has a broad-based gait, slurred speech. Neurological examination reveals intention tremor, hypotonia, nystagmus. Okay, the lesion structure is correlated with which one of these embryologic origins or embryologic regions. Okay, so a review of your lecture notes would have revealed to you that these are signs that are associated with a cerebellar lesion, all right? And since we're talking about cerebellum, well, this is what it's pointing to, a cerebellar lesion. So what the question is basically asking you is which one of these embryological regions is a cerebellum related to, okay? Is it the diencephalon? What do we have in the diencephalon? Right, everything thalamus, hypothalamus, subthalamus. Okay, your mesencephalon is your midbrain. Very well. What about the metencephalon? The pons and cerebellum. So this would be the most appropriate answer. The myelencephalon, what is that? Right. And your telencephalon? Right, your cortex. Excellent. So let's see how many of you were able to get that right. 57%. Okay. So cerebellar functions. As we're looking at the motor system, we said we want our motor activities to be smooth, to be purposeful, and to be precise. And the cerebellum plays a major role in allowing smooth and precise motor activity. So one of the major functions of the cerebellum is synergy of movement, where it's going to allow your muscles to contract in a purposeful way to bring about a precise activity. And so therefore, if your cerebellum is lesioned, we will have difficulties in performing precise motor activities. Your cerebellum is also very important for maintaining your posture, okay? It's important for maintaining posture, and it does that by mediating your muscle tone. And as we get into the different regions of the cerebellum, you're going to see which aspect of the cerebellum plays a major role in controlling the tone of your trunk. So where does the cerebellum fit into the big picture? We did say that when we would decide in our prefrontal area to perform a particular activity, then that information goes to our premotor cortex, where we have storage of learned motor skills. So we have that stored there. That information is then going to go to our primary motor cortex that sends the information to our basal ganglia. And we looked at the basal ganglia yesterday, and we saw how the basal ganglia was able to modulate that activity, send the information back to the thalamus, and then that was relayed back to the primary motor cortex so the activity could be carried out. Now, information is also carried to your cerebellum, and your cerebellum is going to assess that information. So you want to perform a particular activity, but if you notice there are lots of other input that's going to the cerebellum, your cerebellum is also going to receive sensory input in terms of where is this particular limb at this point. And if I want to carry out this activity, how do I need to move the limb? So it's going to be involved in some amount of planning. And then as I'm carrying out that activity, your cerebellum is going to be receiving information about where your limb is in space and time, so that if you need to modulate that activity, you can actually do that. And once the cerebellum receives that information, it makes, I don't want to say it makes decision, but it modulates that information based on the other sensory information that is coming to the cerebellum. That information is relayed to the thalamus. The thalamus then takes it back to your primary motor cortex, which allows for the actual modulation to occur. If the information cannot get back to the primary motor cortex, well, then there will be no modulation of the activity. So for us to execute any particular movement, we have lots of information that needs to be fed into our motor cortex. Of course, we have to be motivated to do that particular activity, and we saw that that was coming from our prefrontal regions. We also need a sensory context as it relates to what is going on with that activity. We're going to get that from our sensory fibers. And that sensory information is going to be fed both into your basal ganglia and to your cerebellum. We noted that the prefrontal cortex does not feed into the cerebellum. It's going to feed into your primary motor cortex, which will then go to your basal ganglia. Now, in terms of status, what is going on in time and space? Where are my limbs, okay? Your vestibular system, your visual system, your somatosensory system, information from your spinal cord, motor cortex, association area. All of this information is going to be received by the cerebellum. So from this diagram, we're seeing that the cerebellum receives a large quantity of information that it has to make sense of and then direct the motor cortex as it relates to how to carry out this activity or how to modulate this particular activity based on what is going on with the patient and with their environment. So after the cerebellum receives that information, it then gets to the motor, it then relays it to the motor cortex once it has modulated that information, and then there's execution of the movement. But remember, as we said, your cerebellum is going to be modulating the movement as it is in process. Okay, so this is what we basically talked about copies of your motor instructions being sent to your cerebellum, and your cerebellum looks at the instructions, and then it looks at the information that is coming in from all the other sensory pathways, and then it decides what is the best mode of action and sends that back to the primary motor cortex so that our action can be smooth and precise. And if there are any errors, of course, it's going to be reported back to the motor cortex, and it will be corrected. Important to note is that your cerebellum regulates ipsilateral body function. So if I have a lesion in my right cerebellum, I'm going to see the deficits on the right side. If I have a lesion in the left cerebellum, I'm going to see the deficits on the left side. And of course, this is opposite to what we see with a lesion of the cortex that is affecting our motor pathways. So very important to note is that your cerebellar lesions are ipsilateral. With damage to the cerebellum, even a very small portion of the cerebellum that's damaged, you will see some profound signs and symptoms. But these signs and symptoms may recur if the initial insult is removed. And we'll see that especially for patients who are alcoholics, if they decide to stop drinking, well, then we will see some recovery of the deficits. The basic cerebellar anatomy, I know that you would have covered this in your earlier lectures, and I know that you had a lab also that you went through cerebellar anatomy. So this is a review for you. So your cerebellum is divided into hemispheres. You can divide it into hemispheres, and you can divide it into lobes. Now, if we divide it down the center, right, along the vermis, we are going to get two hemispheres, the left and the right. And then if we use the fissures to divide the cerebellum, and the fissures are the large lines that run horizontally, we will get three lobes, okay? And here you can see it's color-coded. We have our anterior lobe. That's the most superior aspect of the cerebellum, your anterior lobe. Then you have your posterior lobe, and your posterior lobe is the largest part of the cerebellum, okay? Now, your horizontal fissure is going to cut your cerebellum, your posterior lobe, sorry, into an upper part and a lower part, as I'm sure you saw in the model. So what we're seeing here is the upper part of the posterior lobe. And then we also have the flocculonodular lobe that is separated from the posterior lobe by the posterior lateral fissure. And of course, in the center, we have our vermis. Okay, we talked about the fissures that separate the lobe already. So again, we're seeing the anterior lobe, the upper part of the posterior lobe. Now in this this diagram here, we see this diagram is a bit off, okay? Your anterior lobe should be about this region here, okay? And what we're seeing here would be actually the upper portion of your posterior lobe. This is the red part. And then this would be the lower portion of the posterior lobe. So this diagram isn't the best to depict the upper and lower aspect of the posterior lobe. But just know that your horizontal fissure is going to divide your posterior lobe into an upper part and a lower part. Now, just like how we have a spinal homunculus, we also saw that we had an homunculus on the cerebral cortex. We also have a homunculus for the cerebellum. And here we can see that your trunk is represented medially, and your limbs is represented laterally. Note well also that in the anterior lobe, the homunculus for the anterior lobe, you see that it's inverted, okay? So your lower limbs are going to be represented towards the upper part, while your upper limbs are represented towards the lower part of your cerebellar homunculus, at least in the anterior lobe. Okay. So apart from dividing your cerebellum into lobes, you also need to know that you have functionally distinct zones. And your functionally distinct zones, they correspond to the lobes. So we have our vestibulocerebellum, and that's your flocculonodular lobe. Okay? And we have afferents from the vestibular apparatus that correlates with your vestibulocerebellum. So therefore, this region is going to be responsible for balance, as we know, the vestibular nucleus, and your eye movements. Balance, eye, and head movements, that would be correlated to your vestibulocerebellum. So if we have a patient who has a vestibular lesion, if you have a patient with a vestibular lesion, they will present with deficits in balance, eyes, and head movement. Your spinal cerebellum is your anterior lobe. And this region of the cerebellum is going to be responsible for limbs and trunk movement, as you did see earlier. So we did see the homunculus on the anterior lobe. So limbs and trunk movement, we will see the anterior lobe or the spinal cerebellum is going to be responsible for that. Your cerebellum is the largest part of the cerebellum. It's your posterior lobe. And this is responsible for integration of motor and sensory feedback. So this is basically your major coordinating area. So this region is going to basically be putting motor and sensory information together and coordinating the activities. Now we know that the cerebellum is attached to the brainstem via the cerebellar peduncles. And your cerebellar peduncles are not only there as for attachments, but they're also there to allow for communication with the brainstem and also communication with the cortex. Okay, so information from the brainstem, cortex, spinal cord, they are going to use the cerebral peduncles to basically communicate information with the cerebellum. And the cerebellum also uses the peduncles to relay information back to the cortex. So you have a superior cerebellar peduncle, you have, and towards the sides, you have the middle and the inferior cerebellar peduncles. So your superior cerebellar peduncles would be mostly responsible for efferent information as it relates to communications with the cerebellum. Okay, so if I want to send information to the cortex, I'm going to mainly use my superior cerebellar peduncles. My middle and inferior cerebellar peduncles, these are mixed, okay? It's mostly afferent, but we do have some efferent fibers that are going to be traveling in our inferior and middle cerebellar peduncles. So we have, as we did say, we have information that's coming from the cortex, from the spinal cord, from the brainstem that needs to get to the cerebellum. So here we see that we have projections from our parietal and temporal lobe, and it needs to get to the cerebellum. So what we're going to do is basically trace the path that it takes. So we're seeing these projections. They're coming from the right side of the brain. And the right side of the brain is going to control what side of the body? The right side of the brain, I'm talking the cortex. Let me say the cortex. The right side of the cortex is going to rise. It's going to control the left side of the body. Now, if you look in the, so this is where they're destined to, the cerebellum. If you look at their final destination, we're seeing that this information is going to go to the left side of the cerebellum. Okay? Therefore, your left cerebellum is going to influence your left side of the body. Okay, remember we said that for cerebellar lesions, we are looking at ipsilateral. Yeah? So my right side fibers coming from the cortex will control left side of the body. So therefore, these fibers need to go to the left side of the cerebellum because, as we said, cerebellar lesions are going to be ipsilateral in their presentation. So these fibers are going to descend through this is going to be the midbrain, as we see our characteristic Mickey Mouse sign. We have a cerebral peduncles here, and they are going to descend through the cerebral peduncles where you have your corticobulbar and corticospinal fibers traveling. Then they get to the pons, where they're going to synapse with deep pontine nuclei, and then they cross over to the left side of the cerebellum. So that now let's look at cerebropontine cerebellar inputs. So many of the outputs from the precentral gyrus and your anterior paracentral lobule, that's going to be, of course, motor information coming from the frontal lobe. These are going to have to travel to your cerebellum to inform the cerebellum of what you would like to do, and at the same time, the cerebellum is going to inform this area of what needs to be done based on this. It's going to look at the plan. Okay, this is what you want to do. this is the information I have, and the cerebellum is going to basically help to modulate that information. And this is basically what we talked about the fibers crossing the midline to control the ipsilateral side of the body. So in this diagram here, we see that we're having information that's coming from the muscle spindles, and we talked about the muscle spindles a few days ago. We said a muscle spindle is responsible for informing the central nervous system of what is going on with our muscles, and also for informing the central nervous system about where our joints and our muscles are in time and space, and that's proprioceptive information. So information from the muscles, here we're seeing it's coming from the muscles of the lower limb, is going to get into the spinal cord. Of course, it's going to travel, it's going to get into the dorsal horn, because it's that sensory information, that information is sensory in nature, all right? So we're talking about our 1A and 1B fibers. And those are going to travel up, and they're going to get to the cerebellum to inform the cerebellum of what is happening as it relates to your joints in time and space. So information would have traveled to the muscle to contract or relax or whatever it is based on the movement that would have been decided by the frontal region of the brain. But that information also needs to go to the cerebellum. Apart from that, the cerebellum also needs to know if this is actually happening and what rate is it happening at. And it's going to use that information to basically determine if you should continue in that particular fashion or if you need to modulate your movement based on what's happening within the environment. Okay, now we have our ventral spinocerebellar tracts. And again, this is going to be associated with proprioception. So we have our proprioceptive information coming in from our 1D fibers. And in this instance here, we're seeing that it's crossing the midline, it ascends, and then it crosses again. So this is what we would call a double crossing. So with this double crossing, you're going to have the ipsilateral control of your muscles. Your cuneocerebellar pathway, cuneo as in cuneus, all right, that's responsible for your upper limbs. So here we see this pathway is going to be receiving information about muscle stretch, about proprioception. That information, again, just as we saw in the lower limb, is going to travel into the dorsal horn, ascend into and synapse onto your accessory nucleus, and then it's going to cross over to get to your cerebellum. Now, what's the differences and the similarities between your cerebellar and your cerebral cortex? So, your cerebellar cortex, it's similar to your cerebral cortex. Well, they're found below the meninges, so of course, we're going to see them below the meninges. We have subcortical white matter in both cerebellar and cerebral cortex. Now, embedded within the white matter, we have clusters of nuclei. So in the cerebral cortex, we're going to call that our basal ganglia. And in the cerebellum, we don't necessarily have a name for all of them together, but we're going to see them in a few. And they're going to be responsible for modulating the information as it relates to motor activity, just as the basal ganglia is responsible for modulating the information for motor activity in the cortex. Now, your cerebellum is close to the fourth ventricle, is associated with the fourth ventricle, and your cerebrum, of course, we know it's associated with the lateral ventricle. So both of them have ventricular associations. And that's as much as it gets for the similarities between the cerebellum and the cerebrum. So let's look at cortical organization and cerebellar output. Important to note that for the cerebellar output, the chief cell that is associated with that type of organization is your Purkinje cell. All right, so your Purkinje cell is associated with cerebellar output. From this diagram, we can see we have three layers. We have our granular layer, which is the innermost layer. We have the Purkinje layer, which is the smallest, and then we have the molecular layer. Deep inside, we have our cerebellar nuclei, and your Purkinje fibers are going to be influencing the cerebellar nuclei. What we're seeing too is that we have climbing fibers and mossy fibers that will also be communicating with your cerebellar nuclei. Your climbing fibers and your mossy fibers, these are fibers that will be bringing information from the cortex or from the brainstem, from the spinal cord, okay? And your Purkinje fiber, as I said, those are going to be the ones that are resident to the cerebellum, and they're going to be the chief output cell. So what we're seeing here, all right, we have our granular cells, and Mr. Granular cells is actually going to ascend, and then it divides into parallel fibers. Your parallel fibers are going to synapse onto your Purkinje fibers, and they're going to have some influence over your Purkinje fibers. Your Purkinje fibers, as we see, they're going to be communicating with your deep cerebellar nuclei, and that's going to modulate the information. And your Purkinje cells, these are going to be the output cells that communicates with the efferent, or that gives input to the efferent pathways, I should say. Important to note, your Purkinje cells, they're inhibitory in nature, so they release GABA. Your granular cells, this is excitatory in nature, so this is a glutamatergic cells. So your granular cells are glutamatergic in nature. I think all the other things that are here we talked about already. Okay, so we did say that the Purkinje cells, they're going to synapse on to your Purkinje cells. So these parallel fibers, they're coming from the granular cells. As we see, they ascend, and then they, your granular fibers ascend, and then they divide into these lateral fibers that are called parallel fibers. That will excite your Purkinje fibers, which we said that they were inhibitory in nature. Okay, so we were talking about the nuclei earlier. Now, these are the nuclei. We have the dentate nucleus, the interposed nucleus, and the fastigial nucleus. And these are associated with different parts of the cerebellum. So we see that the posterior cerebellum, the most lateral part of your cerebellar hemispheres, is associated with your denticulate nucleus. Then we see that the most medial part of the cerebellar hemisphere is going to be associated with your vestigial nucleus. So that's going to be your vermis. And we also have your flocculonodular nodular lobe is going to communicate with your vestigial nucleus. Now your paravermal zone, and what we saw in the homunculus, is this is where our limbs are going to be controlled by our paravermal zones. These are going to associate with your interposed nucleus. Now we talked about information that was moving in to the cerebellum, so that you can inform the cerebellum of the planned motor activity and what's happening. Now information needs to move out of the cerebellum so that it can go back to the cortex and advise the cortex on how to carry out those activities. So here we see the Purkinje cell axon, and we said earlier that your Purkinje cell would be your chief output cell, and your Purkinje cell would be communicating with your efferent fibers that will be traveling to your cortex to inform the cortex of what needs to be done. The blue fibers that we see here, these would be your fibers that are traveling to the cerebellum to inform the cerebellum of what is going on. Okay, so let's look at the relationships of the functional zones and manifestations if we have lesions. Our vestibular cerebellum, we did identify this as our flocculonodular nodular lobe. And as you know, it's responsible for movements of the head and the eyes, and it's also important in maintaining balance. So if we have a disturbance to our vestibular cerebellum, what will we see? We will see nystagmus, which can also be described as ocular ataxia. We will see the patient's head tilted to the affected side. We'll see titubation, and titubation is basically head nodding, or if you want to call it head bobbing. And the patient will also have truncal ataxia, and they can actually fall to the affected side. They can have impaired tandem walking. Tandem walking is what you're asked to do if a police officer stops you and they suspect that you are drunk. What do they ask you to do? Walk a line, all right? So patients who have cerebellar lesions cannot do this effectively, okay? The reason for their wide-based stance or wide-based gait is because they have difficulty with balance. And so they open their legs, yes, so that they can actually feel a little bit more confident in terms of not falling. Your spinocerebellum, that's your anterior lobe. And with your spinocerebellum, as we saw, it's responsible for the trunk, okay? So that's going to be responsible for helping us to maintain posture. These patients, if they have a lesion of a spinocerebellum, we can see ataxia of the limb, and of course it's going to be ipsilateral. And we can see, of course, gait disturbances, and the patient is going to fall towards the side of the lesion, as we would have discussed. Okay. Now, there are several diseases that can actually affect the cerebellum. Actually, there are lots, and we're just going to look at a few. Now, if we have a midline astrocytoma, which is usually seen in children, what structures will be affected? We're thinking about midline. Midline, the middle of the cerebellum, what do we have there? We have the vermis, but if you're thinking in terms of functional zones, all right, remember we said that you had a cerebellar homunculus, and we saw in the anterior lobe, yes? We saw that the cerebellar homunculus was turned upside down. And towards the center, or the midline, we saw it was responsible for controlling the trunk, okay? So these patients, if they have a cerebellar lesion that's affecting the midline, of course you will see truncal ataxia. All right, that's what I was trying to get at. Then you can also see nystagmus. Of course, you'll have a broad-based stance because the patient has problems with balance. Hypotonia. Remember, we talked about this a few lectures ago. We said that hypotonia is associated with lower motor neuron lesions, but patients who have cerebellar lesions can also present with hypotonia. So then how do you know if it's a lower motor neuron lesion that they have, or if it's a cerebellar lesion? Well, then you have to look for other signs. A patient who has a cerebellar lesion, they will also have ataxia, they may have nystagmus, they may have problems with balance. Why you don't necessarily see all of these in someone who has a lower motor neuron syndrome? Now, because this is a space-occupying lesion, we will see classical signs and symptoms of a space-occupying lesion. So headache, nausea, vomiting. We may see hydrocephalus because, of course, we know our cerebellum is closely associated to our fourth ventricle. So we'll see classical signs of increased intracranial pressure along with symptoms that are associated with a cerebellar lesion. You can have a cerebellar stroke. Of course, it's going to be due to a lesion that is affecting the blood supply to the cerebellum. And of course, your presentation is going to be ipsilateral based on which part of the cerebellum is affected. Now, what will we see? We can see this artery. What's this artery? Artery. Right, you have difficulty articulating words. So someone who has a speech disturbance, it may not only be because of something that's affecting your Broca's or Wernicke's area, okay? So we see that the cerebellar lesion can affect articulation. And that makes sense because speaking requires motor activity, not so? And even that has to be modulated or controlled by your cerebellum to some extent in terms of the contraction and relaxation of your muscles that are necessary for articulation. We can see dyssynergia or dyssynergism, and that is, of course, ipsilateral, and it can present as dysmetria. So in dysmetria, you have a difficulty measuring. So yesterday, I asked the student to come up, and I asked him to basically touch my fingers, okay? So the patient with dysmetria cannot assess the exact location of where my fingers are. So basically, they kind of overshoot the point. So let's say I'm asking them to touch the finger here. They're overshooting because they can't, although nothing is wrong with their eyes, they can't effectively assess where the finger is to touch it. And you can imagine someone who has that problem might have difficulty buttoning their shirt or doing other functions that requires you to estimate distance. Then there's dysdiadokinesis. Now, dysdiadokinesis, the patients have difficulty performing repetitive activities. And one thing that we usually ask them to do is, all right, so this seems like something simple, but you need your cerebellum to actually modulate that. So patients who have a cerebellar lesion will not be able to do that effectively. And then yesterday I was talking about the heel to shin. Was it yesterday? Yes, it was yesterday. The heel to shin test, that too, that's where you take your heel and basically rub it down your shin over and over again. Okay? Repetitive activity. The patient with a cerebellar lesion will have difficulty performing such activities. We'll see an intention tremor. Yesterday we talked about a resting tremor. The resting tremor is seen in patients who have Parkinson's disease. Or intention tremor is seen in patients who have a cerebellar lesion. What's the difference with resting and intention tremor? With resting tremor, the tremor is exacerbated when you're not doing anything. Okay? But as you're about to do a particular activity, we see a disappearance or a decrease in that tremor. Someone who has an intention tremor, when they're resting, you don't necessarily see anything. But as you ask them to do a particular activity, you see the tremor. And so, for example, if I ask a patient who has a cerebellar lesion to touch his nose, if the cerebellar lesion is on the right side and he takes his right hand and he tries to touch his nose, you're going to see the tremor pronounced as he gets to the point that he wants to touch. All right? Okay? So that would be your intention tremor. Now, if this patient, the same patient who has a lesion in the right cerebellum, if he takes his left hand and tries to touch his nose, what's going to happen? He's going to have success, all right? It's going to be smooth, it's going to be purposeful, and it's going to be precise because the lesion is on the right side of the cerebellum, and so we'll have ipsilateral presentation. Okay, so you'll have limb ataxia. You'll have truncal ataxia because you can't maintain the tone in your limbs and your trunk. You can also see brainstem signs because the cerebellum and the brainstems would share similar arterial supply. Oh, sorry, where is that one? Oh, rebound phenomenon. So, I take the patient's hand, yes, and I try to pull. And then they pull, okay? They pull as much as they can. When I let go, all right? So if for example, for me, if you pull, and, I don't have a cerebellar lesion, hopefully, yes? When you let go, yes. But the patient who has a cerebellar lesion, if I have a cerebellar lesion, God forbid, when you let go pulling, some of the patients can even knock themselves, all right? So sometimes you have to protect them depending on what you're doing, okay? So that would be your rebound phenomenon. So malnutrition can also affect patients, and cause a cerebellar lesion, especially the malnutrition that's associated with alcohol abuse, all right? And we know that's timing deficiency. So what that actually cause, it causes degeneration of your Purkinje cells. And we know that the Purkinje cells would be the chief output cell for the cerebellum. And so the patients will develop or present with cerebellar lesions. Okay? Now, as we said earlier, cerebellar lesions have the potential to recover if whatever is the inciting pathogen or inciting event, if it would have been removed. And so patients who decide to give up the bottle, all right, they may see some recovery of their symptoms. The Loeys-Barre syndrome, now this is an autosomal recessive disorder, so this is a genetic hereditary disorder that affects your Purkinje cells, and as we know, your Purkinje cells are very important for cerebellar output. And these patients can present with delayed development of motor skills. As you can imagine, a functioning cerebellum would be very effective in helping you to develop your motor skills. And the most obvious signs would relate to walking. Okay, so of course you're going to see like ataxia. Talking, as we said, we needed our cerebellum for articulation, facial expression, and ocular movements. Okay? On these patients, their skin and eyes tend to express small dilated blood vessels. Of course, this is not associated to the cerebellar lesion, but this is another finding that we can see with these patients, and they have increased vulnerability to cancers. Now, apart from motor deficits in cerebellar lesion, it has been shown that we can have cognitive defects also, and it's said to be called dysmetria of thought. Okay, so these patients have emotional blunting. They may exhibit depression, disinhibition, and psychosis. Their executive functions may also be affected. So apart from the motor symptoms that we would see in patients, which are most classical for cerebellar lesions, there also may be some cognitive deficits, and that's usually when the posterior lobe is affected. I think this slide is in the wrong place. All right. So we talked about all these symptoms already. Now, these particular symptoms will be associated with the cerebellum. So this slide needed to be before all of this. Anyway, your cerebrocerebellum, as we saw, was your posterior lobe. And the dysmetria, the dysdiadokinesis, the intention tremor, the hypotonia, the rebound phenomenon that we talked about that we can see in a cerebellar stroke, these would be mediated by a lesion to the posterior lobe. So your posterior lobe is going to, if you have a lesion to the posterior lobe, we will see the dysmetria, the rebound phenomenon, all of these signs that we talked about already. So we talked about what they were already, but we did not associate them with a particular part of the cerebellum. So to note, these are associated with the cerebrocerebellum. So this patient comes to us because he has problems with balance. A neurological examination reveals titubation. And what is a titubation? The head nodding. And nystagmus. So which of the following structures is most likely affected? Is it the cerebrocerebellum? Cerebrocerebellum is affected. What type of symptoms would we see? Ataxia, dysmetria, dysdiadokinesis. Rebound phenomenon, all of that we would see with our cerebrocerebellum. The cerebral peduncles, also known as your crus cerebri, if that's lesion, will we see these symptoms? No, because that is not related to the cerebellum. Your rostral medulla? Nope. Pontine tegmentum? No. So these lesions, these symptoms that we're seeing, they're cerebellar in nature, so it has to be something that's some part of the cerebellum. What about the vestibular cerebellum? Very well. So your vestibular cerebellum would be the correct answer. Before we check to see how many of you got that right, what about the spinal cerebellum? What does that do? Your spinal cerebellum is associated with what lobe? Your anterior lobe, all right? Okay, so 80% of you are able to get that correct. So you may take your break. I think that's the last slide. And we'll come back for reflexes.